kind of pick back up where we were, we had talked a little bit about the end of the Civil War. We had talked a little bit about Reconstruction and defined it. And then, of course, we got into the political nature of Reconstruction, Johnson versus the Radical Republicans. And ultimately, that led to Johnson's impeachment. And even though he was allowed to stay, he only serves one term. And that really paves the way for a gentleman by the name of Ulysses S. Grant to be elected president of the United States in 1868. So think about it. You've got the 13th Amendment in 1865. You've got the 14th Amendment by 1868. And ultimately, you'll have the 15th Amendment by 1870. These are your three Civil War amendments that abolished slavery, gave everyone, including black, citizenship, and then the 15th Amendment, which ultimately provided for giving black men the right to vote. And of course, who is really disgusted and really upset at the 15th Amendment? It's women, who had had their first women's rights convention in 1848 at Seneca Falls, New York, and were working just as hard for the right of suffrage or the right to vote. I want to switch from the political nature of Reconstruction to the economic forces, okay? We can't imagine what it would have been like to not only be told that you were free, but also have nothing of your own economically. And those are the two contrasts, particularly for African Americans and to some measure poor whites. As Reconstruction begins, Civil War soldiers on both sides come home to land that had been torn up. If you were living in the Midwest or the South or a few places in the North, land has been torn up. Farm fields have been turned into impromptu cemeteries. And you're looking to just put your life back together. I mean, that's what war does. It disrupts life. So if you're a former African-American, you may move west and become an exoduster, move to Kansas, because you don't want to live on your former master's land, even if it means serving on a small plot of that land to have as your own. And by the way, that was called sharecropping. 90% of all African-Americans in the South will be a part of sharecropping at some point after the Civil War. This is not a great way to get rich. It's an excellent way to stay poor, and it's an excellent way for white landowners, good or bad, to keep everybody in their same economic station. Remember that African Americans were trying to exude the bottom rung on top attitude on the social ladder. A lot of whites, not all, but a lot of whites were concerned about people moving out of the usual, moving out of their usual economic station, and disrupting the social sphere, not just of the American South, but the North as well. To that degree, some laws begin to show themselves, whether as a part of de facto segregation by custom, or de jure segregation by law. And these laws were called Jim Crow laws. And Jim Crow laws were designed to keep folks separate. Jim Crow laws were certain social codes. For instance, if you're an African-American man, a black man, and you're walking on the street and you see a white woman, probably best to step out of her way and not to make eye contact. Later on, that these kind of laws, de jure laws, transcend into the very famous court case in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, which claimed that separate but equal was legal, or a case in Birmingham, Alabama, in the 1960s, where if you were going to be a restaurateur, a restaurant owner in Birmingham, you had to have a 7-foot wall in your restaurant to divide whites from blacks. I mean, these are good examples of official and unofficial laws that that begin to separate races, and not only separate races, but also stereotype them. Jim Crow, the words Jim Crow, stood for an African-American theater character who just doesn't quite have it all together. And unfortunately, that'll be a stereotype that a lot of whites use against freed African-Americans during this time. So economically, you could be an exoduster. You could be a sharecropper. There were a few examples of where African-Americans were able to obtain their own land, were able to bring other African-Americans to the area and do quite well economically. But that wasn't always the case. William Tecumseh Sherman had advocated for giving every former slave or slave family something called 40 acres and a mule, you know, something to start with. But of course, the federal government is going to not go along with that too well. But things like 40 acres and a mule, sharecropping, Jim Crow laws, you know, these were things that and ideas that are going to impact and that will impact freed blacks during this particular time. Another thing that poor whites and African Americans did during this time was called the crop lien system, where you didn't necessarily rent yourself out to your former landowner, as is the case in sharecropping, but you basically rented materials and farm implements from the local merchant. And of course, you had to give a healthy share of the crop to that merchant. And also tenant farming. Tenant farming could be a way where, you know, a person pays rent to a landowner. And again, a lot of that time, that rent came from whatever the crop was, or how well the crop did. So the crop lien system, tenant farming, and sharecropping are ways to, work in the South if you were an African American or a poor white, maybe not necessarily a landowner during Reconstruction. One of the things that the government set up for African Americans during Reconstruction was something called the Freedmen's Bureau. And the Freedmen's Bureau was a way to provide education, welfare for freed blacks. And it was led by a really neat guy, a guy by the name of Oliver O.H. Howard. He had lost an arm in the early part of the Civil War, 1861-62. He was a graduate of West Point. He was a great man of faith. And, you know, the goal of the Freedmen's Bureau was to help African Americans find work, okay, obtain an education. You know, it's a great idea, but much like some government programs over the course of American history, it's just not funded enough. There's not enough support for it over time to really help it. And one of the things that we're going to find is that Americans have short attention spans, and by 1877, there are other things going on in the country that will allow Reconstruction to fall short as a viable mechanism for civil rights and ultimately preserving the country as and the Union as Abraham Lincoln wanted. But it also does some good things too, as we'll see. A couple more things about Reconstruction in the time that we have. You know, one of the best things about the early part of Reconstruction, 1868 to about 1872, is that when Ulysses S. Grant comes into power, he is able to use the power of the federal government to crush the Ku Klux Klan. And this was a great thing because the Ku Klux Klan was basically the terrorist wing of the Democratic Party. A lot of the Democrats were out of power in the South during those 10 years of military Reconstruction. They argued for home rule, you know, for things not changing economically and socially for the African American. But by 1872, 73, things like the using the power of the federal government in the South, and also using the power behind the two force acts that Congress will sign to break the Klan, will be usurped, will be, you know, taken over by things like Indian wars and also the corruption of the Grant administration. Not that Grant was tied to any of the four major scandals during his administration, but you know, he was the president. He's somebody that is supposed to be in charge. And so Indian wars and local government corruption, federal government corruption, is going to start to take the attention away from equal rights for blacks. There was also a major economic panic in 1873, and it was over the question of greenbacks. Do you want more paper money in circulation backed by gold, or do you want, you know, less paper money? And that'll be a big, big thing in the early 1870s. And the panic of 1873 will precede the largest panic to date up to that point in American history, which was 1893. So, you know, unfortunately, we have short attention spans, and countries do too, and that's something for us to kind of think about and ponder. A culminating thing during Reconstruction was the election of 1876. Samuel Tilden, a Democrat, running for president against Rutherford B. Hayes. This is going to be a disputed election. It's during Reconstruction, so in states like South Carolina, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, they're going to be an issue of Reconstructed votes and counting the black vote. You know, you find that between 1868 and 1872, the South Carolina legislature itself is largely black. But over time, these governments began to become solid white and Democrat over again. So by 1876, it looks like Samuel Tilden, a Democrat, is going to win the federal election. But there's a problem of disputed votes, and there's no electoral winner. One of the things that occurs is that there's a special election commission chosen. And that special election commission chosen will ultimately choose Hayes. Hayes will be given the reconstructed disputed votes. One of the things that helped Hayes was that he promised to only serve one term. And also his wife was a teetotaler, which simply means she did not drink alcohol nor serve alcohol. So, you know, people could stand, if that's the right word, electing Hayes if it meant continuing Reconstruction. Southerners, you know, go ape crazy in many places about this election and the way it's decided. So some people will have what's called a compromise of 1877, and this is something that you really need to know for your test, because this is a major marker, a major turning point in American history. You have a disputed election, much like, you know, in theory, the election of 2000, where you have disputed votes in Florida between Mr. Al Gore and Mr. George W. Bush. It shakes up the country. It leads to bad feelings. So folks wanted to solve this as quickly as possible. And so some people say that there was a deal made, and that deal made is called the Compromise of 1877. The Compromise of 1877 will allow for Hayes to become president. It will allow for more Southern politicians to be admitted to the federal Congress over time. And it'll also help to make the South a little more solidly Democratic. And what do a lot of these Southern Democrats want in these Reconstructed states? It's home rule. It's the ability to make their own decisions about politics and Reconstruction. They also want those damn Yankee soldiers to leave the South. And so that's another compromise from the 1876 election. The troops will leave the South, Union troops. There'll be more Southerners admitted to the federal Congress over time, and Rutherford B. Hayes will be president, a Republican, promising to serve one term. You know, there'll only be two Democratic presidents from 1865 to 1912, to the 1912 election, when Woodrow Wilson becomes, you know, another Democratic president. You'll have Benjamin Harrison and Andrew Johnson and Woodrow Wilson to be the only Democratic presidents during this time. And here's one reason why. Republicans, during campaigns, would do something called wave the bloody shirt. And waving the bloody shirt was reminding people about who won the Civil War. It was the Union. It was the Grand Army of the Republic that won the Civil War. So, but that's a good example of this compromise, too, that slowly over time there will be the ability for more Democrats, both at the state level and the federal level and the presidential level, to have a shot at that kind of leadership. But home rule was devastating to African Americans in the South in most cases. Over time, you will have literacy tests and poll taxes and grandfather clauses that will come up that will begin to restrict the progress of the 14th and 15th Amendments. Bottom rung on top, in most cases, many cases, is going to be an illusion for African Americans. You know, those black sharecroppers will not be given always the best crop of land to work. And what will that lead to? Low yields in a lot of cases, poverty, debt. And this was a way for many Southerners, not all, but many Southerners, to keep people economically, again, here's that phrase, in their place. Having said that, in places like rural Tennessee, African American communities will thrive. They'll thrive around their religion and their faith and their commitment to each other, their commitment to protecting one another against the hate of the Ku Klux Klan, who is largely representative of the ghosts of Confederate soldiers during this time, intimidating blacks from voting, intimidating blacks from trying to get an education. And it's not going to be a pretty sight. I think if you've seen a movie that really depicts this about disputed votes and terrorism, I think the last 30 minutes of a movie called Free State of Jones, starring Matthew McConaughey, is probably the best example of what Reconstruction was like in some places. There's two terms that we want to finish with that you might want to think about, and that is this idea of the Solid South. The Solid South is a solid Democratic South. It's a Democratic South where de jure and de facto segregation will be very much intact. Again, this is not to say that it doesn't happen in the North, because 19 years after the Compromise of 1877, you have the Plessy versus Ferguson case coming out of Louisiana, a Supreme Court case that established separate but equal. And in reality, we know that Jim Crow laws actually started in the North and will move down south. So this is the failure, ultimately, of Reconstruction across the board. In 1898, just 2 years after the Plessy versus Ferguson case, you end up having the worst race riot in America in the last 20 years. The United States Senate has apologized for the race riot in Wilmington, North Carolina, where upon the election of a predominantly black city government, white populace, as they call themselves, will get their weapons and their shotguns and rampage through the black community, encouraging African Americans to leave the city on a train. Some people are murdered. Some people left. And today there's a beautiful monument along the Cape Fear River about just recognizing that the race riot occurred. And it's a beautiful monument. I've stood there myself and seen it and felt it. So what do we know after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, that race will take on profound meanings, that race and economics will have huge repercussions on the heels of the Civil War leading into our own time. Race and politics will be things that just won't go away, that they'll run hand in hand together, and that things will always be a little under the surface, and that both parties and other parties will play on the race question to try to win elections. So Reconstruction starts out pretty good. It ends pretty bad, and it ends with goals not necessarily being achieved. But that 13th Amendment is still there. That 14th Amendment is still there. And then ultimately it's going to take a second Reconstruction to fix the problems of voting and segregation during the Civil Rights period in the 1950s and 60s in American history. Thank you.